Welcome to Generation Now, the show by and for millennials and Gen Z on WGTD 91.1 FM. I'm Troy McDonald. Thank you for spending a part of your Saturday morning with us. I was scrolling through YouTube when I discovered the work of our guest today. She articulates and describes our society's conversations about race and voter suppression in such a meticulous and methodical way that enlightened me to my own history as a young African-American man in a way that no high school teacher, no elementary teacher, no teacher, period, or expert ever has. She is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African-American Studies at Emory University. In 2016, she was named one of the thinkers and doers transforming America by Politico. She is also the author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, a New York Times bestseller. Please welcome to Generation Now the incomparable Dr. Carol Anderson. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Troy. Thank you.
So let's start the conversation with kind of describing what white rage is, because I think that kind of dovetails into everything we'll talk about.
Yes. And I think the best way to get at that is to get at it the way that I came to it. I was watching television in August of 2014, and on the news, they were showing Ferguson blowing up, Ferguson, Missouri, after the killing of Michael Brown. And all of the pundits were saying the same thing. Look at all of this black rage. Look at black people burning up where they live. Can you believe black people are burning up where they live? Oh, my God, black people are burning up where they live. Black rage, black rage, black rage. And I had lived in Missouri for 13 years, and I was shaking my head going, that's not black rage, that's white rage. And then I went, wow. And it hit me that in this nation, we are so focused in on the flames that we miss the kindling. And the kindling, those are those policies that are systematically put in place to undermine the advancement of African Americans as they achieve their citizenship rights, their basic human rights, their civil rights.
Well, and I
and what do I mean by that? Mm-hmm. And so that white rage comes through the court systems as we see judicial decisions such as Plessy v. Ferguson, Shelby County v. Holder in 2013. It comes through in legislation. It's cool. It's methodical. It's not the violence that we're used to seeing and being outraged about, but it is the kind of quiet policy making that cuts, undercuts, undermines the full citizenship rights of African Americans as this struggle continues for these basic citizenship rights.
And you talk about the systemic and just ever-present policies we have to discuss in that same vein, kind of localize it with Scott Walker, who was just replaced on Monday by Democrat Tony Evers. But he enacted voter ID laws, which you have said in numerous interviews and in your writing, that was indeed racist, was intentionally racist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so and I think being in Wisconsin, this is a great place to start this conversation. All right. So, you know, in white rage, I talk about these moments of advancement coming out of the Civil War, the Great Migration, Brown, civil rights, and the election of Barack Obama. To understand the tenacity and the ferocity of voter ID laws, we have to understand how the election of a black man to the White House sent this tremor through the system. So one of the things we hear is, how racist can America be? Mm. We elected a black man to the White House twice. But no, we did not, because in saying that in that way, it's to say, how racist can all whites in America be because we whites elected a black man? but not since 1964 have the majority of whites, and 64 is an important date because that's the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
Not since 1964 have the majority of whites who voted for a Democratic candidate for president.
Mm.
And so with the election of Barack Obama, you didn't have a majority of whites vote for him. You had a sizable number, but you had an incredible coalition that came to the fore because of his incredible organizing and ground game of 15 million new voters, African American, Latinos, Asian Americans, young, and the poor. Now, when you begin to think about voter ID laws, they systematically go after that group.
Mm.
And the way that it works is that it seems innocuous.
Right, and most sensible people.
Reasonable.
Right, most sensible
given
people.
Given the kind of Reichstag fire that they talk about, they, basically the Republicans, in terms of massive, rampant voter fraud. So they generate this fear about massive, rampant voter fraud undermining American democracy, when in fact that lie of voter fraud is then used to implement policies to undermine democracy.
How the
voter ID law works.
Right, and most people believe that it's sensible, right? I mean, you need an ID to go to the library, to do basic things. Why isn't that such a great ideal to hold our democracy to, right? That everyone should get an ID. And you have made it clear, you know, in cases in states where they closed the Department of Motor Vehicles and put hurdle after hurdle after hurdle, like it's the Olympics, for people
right.
to jump
okay.
over.
And the thing is that you cannot use your library ID to vote.
Right.
But this is why it seems so innocuous, because they just say, oh, your voter ID, you just need an ID. And people go, oh, everybody's got an ID. One, everybody does not have an ID. Two, not everybody has the kinds of IDs that the legislatures, these Republican-dominated legislatures, right into the law as being the ticket to be able to get in to vote. And like places like North Carolina figured out what types of IDs African Americans had and didn't have, and then wrote the law to privilege those that African Americans did not have. What they did in Alabama was they said you need a government-issued photo ID to vote. And the legal defense fund, the NAACP legal defense fund, looked up and said, okay, you need government-issued photo ID, but we see you don't have public housing ID on here. And they said, no, that one doesn't count. But let's think about it. Does it get more government-issued than public housing?
No, it does not.
Right? But in Alabama, 71% of those in public housing are African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And for many, that's the only ID they have. And so if you eliminate the kinds of IDs that African Americans have, then you're able to eliminate African Americans from the voting booth.
Hmm. Well, we talked about, you know, Scott Walker, who in this state closed down or changed the hours of the DMV. How did that kind of policy take place right here in Wisconsin? Take hold.
And so what you see happening in Wisconsin, so they made it clear, they again, Scott Walker and company, that they were going after Milwaukee, where 70% of the state's African American population lives, and they were going after the college campuses because they think college students are too liberal. So what you do is, and so again, you see this, identifying, and it's taking what they think are the characteristics of those, because the law says, the 15th Amendment is really clear, you cannot discriminate on account of race.
Right.
And so they can't say, we don't want black people to vote, because even that's too blatant for them. So they take the societally imposed characteristics, and so you start shutting down the hours when people can get to the Department of Motor Vehicles. So if you begin to limit the hours, and you know you have a working class population that has to punch the clock, and then you limit the hours when that working class population is actually working so they can't get to the place, that'll work. Or you begin to move those places away from and off of public transportation, because also what we know is that there's a racial disparity in terms of access to privately owned vehicles. Mm-hmm. We've got this data. And by limiting the access, and then even when the courts come in and say, come on, son. Now, you know, of course, they wrote it much more judicially, but they were basically saying, come on. Then what we also know is that by creating confusion in a time-constrained population, so I don't know whether this ID will work. I don't know what I need. I don't know if I can get there. I don't know. By creating that kind of confusion, it also depresses voter turnout. So what we saw in 2016 is that in Wisconsin, there were 60,000 fewer votes cast in the 2016 election than there were in the 2012 presidential election. 60,000. 68% of that decline came out of Milwaukee alone. Trump won Wisconsin by barely over 20-some thousand votes.
Yeah, I mean, you can... It's right there. So I'm going to push back on that, because some people might say, well, Tony Evers was just elected as the Democrat here, won with 47,000 surplus votes from Milwaukee. That kind of pushed him over the edge. So was the problem in 2016 not just, you know, the disenfranchisement, obviously, that you so eloquently laid out, but the fact that there wasn't an interesting candidate there in that particular election at the presidential level at least?
Right, and that is part of the rebuttal. And so let me answer that. In 2016, that was the first election where we didn't have, A, the protection of the Voting Rights Act, but you also saw the full kind of implementation of the, across the nation, of these voter suppression laws in over 30 states. After that stunning voter suppression and Russian-aided victory for Donald Trump, then you had massive grassroots mobilization, because now it's like, oh, wow, these folks really don't play fair, really don't play fair. So you have organizations like Vote Riders who are like, okay, we're not even going to argue about the pros and cons of voter ID. We're just going to do the heavy lifting to get people the ID that they need. And so that means if we need birth certificates, we're going to go the long haul to get people to the places where they can get their birth certificates so that then they can get the ID that they need in order to vote. And so what you saw happening was massive grassroots mobilization to overcome the voter suppression tactics and laws that have been put in place. So it wasn't like, oh, 2018 shows that voter suppression doesn't work. In fact, what it shows is that you need massive mobilization at the grassroots level to overcome the voter suppression tactics that are put in place to suppress the voting rights of American citizens.
There was a state in the South, and it jogs my memory at this point, but where they had the state define the moral turpitude clause and
Alabama,
thank you, and figured out a way to have mugshots be used as photo ID.
Right.
Yeah, just fast. I mean, so you're right, but it took a lot of effort and dedicated organizations down there in Alabama during the Roy Moore and Doug Jones election.
Yes, Yes, I mean, and so let me do a brief kind of piece on that. In 1901, Alabama, in its Jim Crow Constitution, it rewrote its Constitution to embed these kinds of Jim Crow laws in there. One of them dealt with felony disfranchisement. And it said, if you have been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude, you have lost your right to vote. And if you try to vote, if you have been convicted of a crime, you will be charged with another felony and thrown in jail. Wow. Mm. Now, there is no law in the books called moral turpitude. So folks don't know that if they've been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude or not. And so what that did, and you have organizations going in, going, suing the state, define it. It took decades of lawsuits. Finally, in 2017, remember, this has been on the books since 1901.
Jesus.
In 2017, Alabama finally passed a law that defined moral turpitude. By that time, 8% of Alabama's adult population could not vote. 15% of its black population could not vote because of this moral turpitude statute. Once moral turpitude was defined, rape, murder, treason, the biggies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not drug crimes. Then these organizations turned to the Secretary of State and they said, okay, all of those folks that you told they had lost their voting rights, now go and tell them that they actually have them. And he said, I don't think that's a good use of state resources.
Mm.
So then you have grassroots organizations and civil society then doing the heavy lifting of democracy, informing all of these people that they may actually have the right to vote, and then getting them registered. But the state was like, we don't see any need in doing that.
So we're going to punish, indirectly punish them, I mean, for the victory of defining moral turpitude. So we defined it, but I mean, it's just unbelievable. And like you say in so many of your talks, this is not the Klan. This is not cross burning. This is done by people in respected positions of power, at least as we define them today, in the United mm-hmm. States government.
And so think about respectable folk stopping 15% of the adult black population from voting. Now, if we saw that, and that's what I mean by we're so focused in on the flames that we miss the kindling. So if this was a massive Klan march, and we had cross burnings and folks in sheets and tiki torches, we'd have the cameras on there going, oh my gosh. But because these are these little quiet laws where people are just systematically and quietly removed, separated from their basic right to vote, we don't see it.
Hmm.
It's the same, the Brennan Center did a study and found, for instance, with voter roll purges, that millions of people had been removed from the voting rolls. Yet we don't see, it's not like we see the chalk outlines of those bodies,
mm-hmm.
of their electoral bodies. And so it just quietly happened.
But to push back, is that part of our fault, not just African Americans, but society, because we're so mm-hmm. drawn to the flames that we ignore a lot of this stuff?
Yes. And that's so I get these questions after my talks on white rage when I'm going around the nation. And I get the, what can we do? And there's several things that we can do. But one of them is to understand that the price of democracy really is eternal vigilance.
Mm.
And that we hear this language of, you know, we have to protect. How? Really? What's the impact? You know, we don't ask the questions because we're not even paying attention as these laws are coming forth. Hmm. But they do damage, and that requires us to be vigilant. When we're not vigilant, bad things happen.
Hmm. And we're talking kind of about, you know, how different, you know, different ways that we can go about solving this issue. But there is a debate within the Black community. Just this week, there was a Tennessee judge who said that Black men killing each other are being more successful at killing Black men than the KKK ever has. And the NAACP in that area came out in support of the judge who said that, while Black Lives Matter activists, who tend to be, you know, millennials my age, were kind of, you know, up in arms about the NAACP support. So can you talk about the divide between kind of millennial African Americans and the way they go about solving these issues and kind of the traditional NAACP and those kinds of organizations and how they're viewing how we tackle these issues?
Okay. You mean old folk my age?
No.
And so this is also where I think we need to be more nuanced. So the NAACP, for instance, in Alabama, during that Doug Jones, Roy Moore election, they were central to the fight against voter suppression, against racism. The way they mobilized was amazing. But that Alabama NAACP may not be the other NAACP. So mm-hmm. we've got to be careful as we talk about the ways that these organizations respond. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, NAACP has thousands of branches, and they've got 50 state organizations. But you've got a framing. And I think part of the problem is that we see things sometimes too Manichaean. Mm. It's either this or that, when it can be some of both, and we need to be working on all of it. And that judge, Lord help him. You know, I'm in Atlanta now. I'm from the Midwest.
Oh, really?
But since I live in Atlanta, I can really go Southern. Bless his heart.
Right. Where, if you don't mind me asking, where are you from in the Midwest?
Ohio.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, Ohio. Yeah.
So the
kind of sense of there. Let me back up, because we're dealing also with these kinds of stereotype tropes that I've got to work through. Mm-hmm. So the trope of black on black crime, right? Mm-hmm. Black folk kill black folk. And there is enormous grief within the community, and that grief is often overlooked in the broader white society. It's like black folk don't mind killing black folk because, you know, it's not like they grieve. It's like during slavery times when babies would be yanked away from their mothers. Well, you know, black mothers don't care about their kids. So this is really no big deal. Those kinds of tropes that deal with the anesthetization of feelings in the black community help them create policies that are cool with the deaths. Then you get the kinds of frustration from old folk, how's that? Who are like, we got to stop killing each other, but we've got to look at a lot of the structural issues beneath those killings. And we also have to look at the reality, you know, because you get black-on-black crime as this kind of trope that's the same as saying black kids don't care about school, the same about talking about black rage, look at them burning up where they live, this narrative of black pathology. Mm.
That we almost believe ourselves. So.
Yes, that we take in ourselves. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I started the introduction in White Rage, is where I began to destabilize those myths of black pathology. And let me just, so what we don't take into account when we talk about black-on-black crime as evidence of black pathology, whites who are killed, most of them are killed by other whites. But you don't hear the narrative of white-on-white crime. Hmm. And it's over 80-some percent of whites are killed by other whites. Just like over 80% of blacks are killed by other blacks. So there is work that narrative of black-on-black crime is doing to reinforce the narrative of black pathology.
And you almost, I think Michael Eric Dyson says that, very famed professor, he says, people kill where they live.
Yes.
And so yes. If you're going to talk about black on black crime, you have to talk about.
You see, right? And I think as well, we also have to be cognizant of, is that there have always been these kinds of generational divides. And so we cannot treat them as unique, or this is the first time this has happened. So back in the 60s, SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, led by Martin Luther King, was having major battles with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. SNCC looked at SCLC as a bunch of old heads. Right? And they called King the Lord. What the Lord gonna do now? So it's really, you know, when you're in the moment, you're like, God, the NAACP. God, the Black Lives Matter. This is standard. We have to understand that it's standard. And we also have to understand that when you're fighting these multiple fronts of violence, of discriminatory violence, of citizenship denial, of basic gutting of your human rights, that there are so many fronts on which to fight, that we need everybody out there fighting in their way.
And that's interesting, because everyone wants to be right, and so everyone thinks they have the right solution. And so you're saying that there can be multiple rights here? This is mind-blowing for a millennial that always has to be right.
Are multiple rights. So for instance, you know, one of the battles that happened previously was this battle between protesting, this kind of direct action protesting, sit-ins, marching, and that this is the way. Then there was like an NAACP group that, and you had NAACP marching in it, but you also had going through the courts. Neither one of those is wrong. You need both. Yeah.
What worries you, kind of want to tail back to 2020 and kind of voter suppression. What worries you the most about 2020?
So much. One is... that, which was the old Southern saying, a dying mule kicks hardest. Hey, I am in the South right now. I can say that. when you saw what the Wisconsin legislature did in its lame duck session, is that those kinds of efforts to weaken democracy, to weaken the ability of people to have a voice in their government, the ability to weaken the rights of people to choose their representatives. That battle will continue, and it requires one... that we're ready for it, that we don't get sucked into these kinds of internal battles that don't strengthen but weaken, that we don't get so... Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a law professor out of UCLA in Columbia and who works on intersectionality, brilliant, she talked about not just being concerned with voter suppression, but being concerned with voter depression. That as you have black communities and brown communities and Asian communities out there mobilizing to vote in order to have that voice, and then to come up short, that people like, wow, we did all of that and we still did, is that the system's so rigged, I just got to stay home. I might as well stay home. It doesn't matter. That kind of voter depression, where it's just like, it doesn't matter, but it does matter. And that's why the other side fights so hard. One of the key things is to understand that what voter suppression is designed to do is not only to attack those who are initially trying to vote, but to create a sense of futility in that community writ large, that it doesn't matter if you vote. So you just stay home on your own.
Mm. And see, that's, I was talking to my boss, who is a baby boomer, and he was like, why do millennials not show up? You know, why are they so upset with Hillary or Bernie or whoever the candidates are? And I said, this generation, from the day they were born, for the most part, have been able to control their experience, whether that's watching the show they want to watch, they don't have to wait at 7 o'clock, whether they want to order delivery and have it, you know, delivered in 20 minutes, you know, Wendy's, whatever. You can control your experience in a way. So when you can't design and it doesn't happen the way you want, it's painful. Because in almost every other aspect, you can control it.
And thank you for that. That's a wonderful insight. I look at it, because, you know, I'm a historian. And I think about the folks who were in 1950s Mississippi, where they clearly had the ability to control your own destiny was so far out of your hands, it appeared. And still, they reached down and found their power.
So you say, I mean, you're obviously a historian. You've sold New York Times best-selling books. What will people remember when, what will society take away from this moment? What should they take away?
That we are in a moment where the United States of America and the people in it are really fighting to determine what this nation is and what it will be. This is a pivotal moment in this nation's history. We can either slide down deeper into the darkness and into, in the epilogue of White Rage, I wrote that what Trump offered his supporters was an America that was a neo-apartheid state.
Mm.
Make America great again was a short way of saying that it would create a vast labor system without rights, particularly as he articulated it for African Americans and Hispanics, that between heavy policing in the black community and ICE and deportations to basically cow these communities into submission, where they were no longer fighting for their rights, and they were simply labor without rights, and so that the resources that they would generate would then flow up into a strata of whites. That was the neo-apartheid vision that Trump offered, and we have to understand that and remember that whites were the only racial or ethnic group that voted in the majority for Donald Trump.
You know, people have asked me, you know, do you think he can win a second term? And I said, it almost doesn't matter what he does. Trump is a feeling as much as he is a candidate. And that's what exactly what you're articulating there, is that, he could grab people by the whatever. He can, I mean, even if there is a tape that has been speculated where he uses the N-word, it almost doesn't matter. And that's what's so scary.
It really doesn't. You know, think about it. It is what he has offered. He didn't offer policies. I wrote this piece up where I said white supremacy is the most destructive drug in America.
Mm.
Because it will make you forsake your God, your country, and your family. And, you know, because what he offers, he didn't offer, like, policies. What he offered was this sense of, I'm going to hurt those folk. And I'm going to tell it like it is. Although everybody knows he lies, and so I still struggle with that. He tells it like it is, but you know he lies, right? So, but what, and so now you're hearing, as people are dealing with the fallout from tariffs, as they're dealing with the fallout from the tax policies, fallout from shutting down the federal government, and people are talking about they are hurting. They are living paycheck to paycheck, but the paycheck isn't coming through, that the tariffs are shutting down their businesses. And there was that quote from I think it was a woman in the New York Times who said, you know, he's hurting us. He's not hurting the people he's supposed to be hurting. In that moment, that was the articulation of his vision of that neo-apartheid state. And the disrupture that, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be on the other side of this. And what I say is that part of his salesmanship is that, you know, everybody knows he's a grifter, he's a con artist. But they thought they were in on the con. Mm. They didn't think that they were the mark. So what I'm also seeing, like the 2018 election, I think was a precursor. So you see on one hand the darkness and the use of every trick in the book to stop people from voting. On the other hand, you saw incredible mobilization and articulation of what a vibrant democracy could be. What does an America look like when the power brokers look like America? That's what 2020 is going to be. It is going to be this massive, definitive moment, I believe, that defines the course of the United States of America.
And how can, as the show is for, you know, we try to target, you know, millennials and Gen Z. Mm-hmm. How can we be more effective in that crusade to make America, I mean, not to steal Trump's line, but to make it great and more diverse for all of us and representative of all of us?
Right. And I saw in this 2018 election it happening. The voter turnout rate for millennials was so much higher than it had been before. You saw the kind of grassroots mobilization in terms of knocking on doors, registering folks to vote, talking to your peers. You know, one of the things that is that sometimes, and this is what I talk about with policy, policy looks so far removed, it's like, yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. But think about it. There was a policy shift in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan. Prior to that time, for this moment coming out from the end of the Second World War up until then, the United States had articulated that education, a college education, was the state's investment in its people. Mm. And this is why you had the GI Bill, but this is also why you had student financial aid packages that were heavy on grants and minimized loans. You're like, what moment was this?
Yeah, yeah, please.
And then it sounds like a fairy tale, doesn't it?
Yeah, my goodness.
But under Reagan, that administration switched the philosophy that said basically a college education was a privilege and you ought to be willing to pay for it. And this is where you get this switch to student loans becoming the predominant part of a financial aid package and grants being minimized in there. That's what policy does. Imagine having policymakers that believe that college education is an investment in its people. Wow. All of a sudden, we've got a very different kind of world happening here for millennials. Imagine if, yeah, right? Imagine if we had policymakers that believed that affordable housing was absolutely essential to the quality of life for American citizens. And then put the heft and the power behind that policy to make it happen. Policies matter, and it's understanding what are it's having these conversations with your peers, with your colleagues, hearing what their concerns are, and being able to then translate that into what those policies mean. Right now, we have in power people who have policy visions, you know, and I think about, for instance, in the White House or in 2010 when there was the Republican sweep, virtually sweep, in the state legislatures, and we began to see how policies changed in those areas because of that, where we started getting the anti-reproductive rights bills, where we started getting the anti-LGBTQ bills, where we started getting the anti-civil rights bills, where we started getting all of the voter suppression bills. That those are those policies that emanated out of the vote. We have the power, and that's what we have to understand, and that we don't cede that power.
Right. That's so interesting that you say that, because you read history books, and I was going to mention this, and we're running a little long here, but what we're going to do is we're going to cut this in half, and we'll have the full thing on our website, because I mean, this is fascinating. But in history books, we read that on the almost like a fairy tale, you know, on the first day, Martin Luther King, you know, rose up from out of nowhere and saved the blacks. And unfortunately, you know, there's a whole bunch of unfortunately. You know, well, it's not unfortunate. These were decisions, deliberate decisions by policymakers. And sometimes it feels we are so far removed. But the New Deal, which was transformative for a lot of people, not blacks necessarily, but it was transformative, was a decision that was made, and we have that power today to make those revolutionary decisions. Why does it seem like we don't have? Is that the way politicians are reaching out to us? Is that the way the media portrays it? Why does it feel like we just don't have the same power or capacity that we used to?
That is a great question, and I think that part of it is that sense that this is so big, it's just out of my hands. There's nothing I can do about it. I remember being in the barbershop with my sons, right? And there was a conversation going on. It turned to crack in the black neighborhood. And there was this kind of sense of hopelessness that we can't fight it because it just keeps pouring in here. But wow, we're not hopeless and we're not helpless. The system is designed to create a sense of hopelessness. But we have elements in the system as well. And that's why you get voter suppression laws that are about that you really do have the power. And if you exercise that power, oh my. I mean, that's why you had the Wisconsin legislature. I mean, they have done everything in there. When you look at those gerrymandered districts.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And now that we're in a holding pattern, waiting to see two other states were picked up by the Supreme Court. We're waiting to see Wisconsin will not rule, or they're not going to make a decision until that decision goes down. So I'm curious, what do you think will happen? I mean, the 2013 gutting of the Voting Rights Act that we talked about doesn't bode well, I guess, for new maps here. But so I'm curious, of course, talk about where we are in Wisconsin, and then how do you think this is going to play out?
I think it is going, you know, I don't even want to make a prediction, because I look at this, and so you see a couple of things. One, you see that the bench has been stacked. We've got some folks on the bench who really have no right to be there. And I mean the U.S. Supreme Court. But we're also in a moment nationally where the institutions of democracy are under such strain that it's a question whether those traditionalists on the U.S. Supreme Court are going to fight to maintain the dignity of those institutions, are just going to roll over and allow the denigration to continue.
Hmm.
And because it's very clear, it's like in North Carolina, their districts are so gerrymandered. And let's be really clear here, too, is that what going through the court system does, and this is why the Voting Rights Act was so essential, what going through the court system does is it allows the discriminatory patterns to continue year after year after year. We're going into almost a decade for North Carolina with its discriminatory districts. And every time it's like, yes, this is discriminatory, but we've got an election coming, so it's too late to change them. But in this last election, Democrats received the overwhelming majority of the votes, over 50% of the votes, well over 50% of the votes, and managed to get 3 of the 10 congressional seats.
Jeez. What do you say to that?
Yeah, and so that's what I mean is when this court looks at that, are they going to say, yo, cool? Or are they going to say, whoa, this so violates the Baker decision of one person, one vote? This is so discriminatory that it undermines democracy. Because what gerrymandering is designed to do is to give people a sense that it doesn't matter how you vote, it's going to be what it's going to be, that person's going to win anyway, or that person doesn't stand a chance, or my voice will never make any difference.
For those of you listening, this is the online version. We're going to wrap this up shortly. but I've just been, let's end with this, because it's the Brown versus Board of Education decision, 1954, Racine County. I did not know this. I was walking downtown Racine, and which is a beautiful area, and there was a statue talking about kind of the desegregation of schools. And there was a placard, and it was really nice. It was like, wow, this is great for Racine. This, I'm so happy for this. And on the placard, it said that Racine County schools were not integrated until 1980. And I had never been taught this. I thought that after 1954, everyone just went into the school, kumbaya, you know, yay, history, you know. And so when I saw 1980, it shook me to my, I said, how, I was born in 1992.
Yes.
I mean, this is crazy. So let's talk about Brown versus Board of Education a little bit as we wrap up here. That work and how that's affecting school districts even to this day.
You know, and so you nailed it. Part of what the myth of the civil rights movement is that after the civil rights movement, all of the barriers for inequality have been removed. And so if black folk aren't making it, that's a culture of poverty, that's a personal decision, that's a personal responsibility issue, right? This is what we hear, that the systemic barriers were removed by the power of the civil rights movement. Civil rights movement did a lot of great work, but it couldn't do everything. And the reality, and that's why I spend a lot of time, I've got a whole chapter devoted to Brown in White Rage. And I didn't put it in with the civil rights chapter because what happened to Brown in with the Brown decision to me is emblematic of how White Rage works. So we know Brown. Brown 1 was the decision to overturn Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal. Brown 2, 1955, was the implementation decision with all deliberate speed. So according to Racine, that's 25 years later, but I digress. What happened after that is that you had massive mobilization by the respectable elements in society, governors, U.S. senators, U.S. Representatives, school board members, on how do we fight Brown? How do we take on the U.S. Supreme Court and stop this decision from ever coming to fruition? And you had things like massive resistance, where they shut down public schools in some areas, like in some areas in Virginia, some areas in Arkansas, shut them down rather than integrate. Then what they did was they took taxpayer dollars and had the legislatures fund tuition vouchers for white children to go to all white private academies, so that white children could continue their education while black children had nothing. This went on for 5 years in an area in Virginia with thousands of black children affected. You also had them taking time to figure out how do we redraw school district boundaries to mirror racial segregation, residential segregation, and to give white parents time to get their children out of these schools that they put in quotes, that are threatened with integration. Threatened. Then you had, by the time, so these battles, you're seeing these court cases. These court cases are taking years and years and years going through. Finally, in the early 1970s, the Supreme Court dealt a 1-2 blow. One blow was the Rodriguez decision. In San Antonio, Texas, in a neighborhood that Edgewood, that is overwhelmingly Mexican-American and African-American, like 96% or something like that. They taxed their property at the highest level possible and could only generate $21 per capita for their students. Taxing their property, because property taxes are the major basis of school funding. Meanwhile, Alamo Heights, which was a predominantly white and well-to-do district in San Antonio, didn't tax themselves at the highest rate at all and generated hundreds of dollars per capita per student. And we know the way that public policy affects property values. And so these parents, remember one of the narratives we hear, these parents don't really care about their kids and they care about education or care about schools. But these parents are taxing themselves at the highest level and can only get $21 per student. They take this case all the way up to the Supreme Court, saying it violates Brown because the structural funding inequality creates basically a separate and unequal school system. U.S. Supreme Court, 5-4 decision, I believe it was, said, equality of funding is not necessary for equality of schools.
That makes no sense.
Hello.
What the?
Hello. The other decision was the Milliken decision coming out of Detroit. Detroit had massive white flight, and so Detroit was over 90% black, and it's trying to, and the tax base is weakened, so they're trying to integrate their schools. But there's just, like, in the words of Aretha Franklin, ain't no way. And so the school board starts drawing these an integration plan that incorporates the surrounding suburbs. The suburbs go ballistic. Case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court rules that because the suburbs were not responsible for the racial segregation that happened in Detroit, they can't be part of the solution. Now, in order to make that decision, the Supreme Court had to overlook Michigan law that, for instance, provided school buses for so many other districts, but not those in Detroit, so that children were left in neighborhood schools, racially segregated neighborhood schools. This is state law.
Wow.
So if you cannot have meet the Brown decision via funding or via racial integration, how are you supposed to do it?
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the good news is that, and we'll end the online version with, on a positive note, that we
yes.
have the power to make the same systemic change if we work together, if we realize, like you said, that democracy is eternal vigilance. That's the way to look at it. Thank you so much. I cannot thank you for
so much. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. You can follow Carol Anderson on Twitter at Prof, P-R-O-F, C. Anderson, at Prof, C. Anderson, and her books, One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, are available wherever books are sold. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Generation Now. We'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.